Welcome to the chapter on neurology. Before we get started, I'd like to take a second and mention that much of the neurophysiology for step one heavily relies on a strong anatomical understanding of the nervous system. This means we'll be covering a lot of anatomy throughout this chapter. Please recognize that you will likely have to take time to pause the videos and memorize a lot of material due to the nature of the content. Our goal is not to focus on memorizing the anatomy with you, rather, it's to provide you with concise figures and tables that will make memorization easier, and then we'll focus on the important physiology and integrate the material by doing many practice questions. In the first section, I will be discussing the cerebral hemispheres and some of the major landmarks in this region. Let's get started. This is figure 8.1 from your text, which is an anterior view of the brain. First, let's go over the major grooves of the brain. These are also called fissures or sulci, and there are four major grooves that you need to be familiar with for step one. These include the longitudinal fissure, the lateral sulci, the central sulci, and the parieto-occipital sulci. Let's look at each of these now. The central groove, which you can see right here, separates the two hemispheres and is called the longitudinal fissure. In this image, you can also see the lateral sulci right here, which separates the inferior temporal lobes from the superior frontal and parietal lobes. So the temporal lobe is this region right here, and we can clearly see the frontal lobe right here. However, it's difficult to see the parietal lobe, so we'll look at that later in figure 8.2. So again, the lateral sulci separate the temporal lobes from the frontal and parietal lobes. In this image, we can see the cerebellum right here and the brainstem. Okay, let's look at a lateral view of the brain. This is figure 8.2, which is a lateral view of the brain. This is posterior, and this is anterior. Again, this is the lateral sulcus right here, and it can be easily seen from this lateral view. We can also see the central sulcus right here, which separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. Finally, the parieto-occipital sulcus is hard to see in this image, but it's approximately right here, and it separates the parietal lobe from the occipital lobe. If we look at a sagittal view of the brain, we can more easily see the parieto-occipital sulcus. As a quick reminder, a sagittal view just means we've cut the brain in half through the longitudinal fissure like this. And we're looking at the inside of the brain from the side, so this is an eye, we'd be looking at it from this angle. Okay, with this in mind, let's look at figure 8.3. This is figure 8.3, which is a mid-sagittal view of the brain. Again, this is anterior and this is posterior. In this image, we can clearly see the parieto-occipital sulcus right here. We'll cover more of the anatomy from this view later, but for now, let's see what your text says. So again, the major grooves of the brain include the longitudinal fissure, the lateral sulci, the central sulci, and the parieto-occipital sulci. Okay, let's return to figure 8.2 and review the major lobes of the brain. As we can see, this is the frontal lobe, and just posterior to it is the parietal lobe. Inferior to the frontal and parietal lobes is the temporal lobe. Finally, the most posterior lobe is the occipital lobe. Again, the four major sulci we covered are helpful in clearly distinguishing between the different lobes. Okay, with this basic overview, let's talk about some of the important functions of the different lobes. Generally speaking, the frontal lobe is responsible for judgment, concentration, orientation, and primitive reflexes. Aside from this, there are three major gyri in the frontal lobe that you need to be familiar with. The first is the precentral gyrus. The name comes from the fact that this gyrus is directly anterior to or in front of the central sulcus, which is right here. hence the name precentral gyrus. This is also sometimes called the primary motor cortex, as we can see in parentheses. And this is because this gyrus is the location of all of the upper motor neurons that are responsible for movement. We'll talk about this more later, but essentially this single gyrus is what allows us to move. If the primary motor cortex is damaged, then the patient will experience complete contralateral paralysis. We'll talk about this more later, but it's important to know that the tracts from the motor neurons decussate or cross over to the opposite side of the body. This is why when the left primary motor cortex is damaged, the right side of the body is affected. Okay, with this in mind, let's do a question. What symptoms should you suspect in a patient who has damaged the left primary motor cortex? So, as we just discussed, the patient would be unable to move the right side of his or her body. This would include the right side of the face, the right arm, and the right leg. So, right-sided paralysis. Again, this is because the tracts from the upper motor neurons from the primary motor cortex decussate or cross over to the opposite side of the body. Okay, the second important gyrus that you need to be familiar with for step one is located right here. This is called the frontal eye field. You need to know that it's anterior to the primary motor cortex and it's associated with eye movement. It's important to know that if the frontal eye field region is damaged, then the patient's eyes will deviate to the ipsilateral side. Okay, with this in mind, let's do another question. How would the left and right eyes be impacted if the left frontal eye field region was damaged? So the left frontal eye field region. So both eyes would deviate to the left. Remember, damage to the frontal eye field region results in deviation of both eyes to the ipsilateral side. Because the left frontal eye field region was damaged, we know that the eye should deviate to the left. The last gyrus that you need to be familiar with in the frontal lobe is located right here. This is called Broca's area. Notice how it's anterior to the primary motor cortex and superior to the lateral sulcus, which is right here. You also need to know that Broca's area is responsible for what some examiners like to call motor speech, which we can see in parentheses. We'll talk about this in more detail later in the chapter, but this just means the patient cannot speak, but the ability to understand what others are saying is intact. Okay, let's see what your text says. So again, there are three major gyri in the frontal lobe that you need to be familiar with. These include the primary motor cortex, the frontal eye field region, and Broca's area. The primary motor cortex is the location of all of the upper motor neurons that are responsible for movement. The frontal eye field region is associated with eye movement, and Broca's area is responsible for motor speech. Okay, let's move on to the parietal lobe. Again, the parietal lobe is right here. It's posterior to the central sulcus, superior to the lateral sulcus, and anterior to the parieto-occipital sulcus. There are two important gyri in the parietal lobe that you need to be familiar with for step one. These include the postcentral gyrus and the angular gyrus, which isn't labeled in this image, but it's about right here. The postcentral gyrus is also called the primary sensory cortex, which we can see in parentheses. And this is just posterior to the central sulcus. This is very similar to the primary motor cortex, but instead of housing the upper motor neurons that are responsible for movement, this cortex is responsible for processing sensations throughout the body. This would include temperature, vibration, proprioception, pain, and so forth. We'll talk about this more later, but it's important to know that the sensory information also decussates or crosses over to the opposite side of the body. This is why when the left primary sensory cortex is damaged, the right side of the body is affected. So for example, if the left primary sensory cortex was damaged, what symptoms would you expect in a patient? Well, the patient would lose sensory information on the right side of the body, so he or she wouldn't be able to feel pain, temperature, vibration, and other sensations on the right side of the body. Okay, the next important gyrus in the parietal lobe is the angular gyrus, which we've pointed out already. And the angular gyrus is associated with performing mathematical calculations, writing, distinguishing left from right, and identifying fingers on the hand. If the angular gyrus in the dominant parietal lobe is damaged, then the patient will be unable to perform these functions, which results in a syndrome called Gerstmann syndrome. It's also important to know that damage to the non-dominant parietal cortex and the dominant parietal cortex will result in different symptoms. If the non-dominant parietal cortex is damaged, then the patients will experience something called hemispatial neglect. Let me write that out. Hemispatial neglect. This is a disorder where the patient has a deficit in awareness to one side of space. For example, if the right parietal cortex is damaged, then the patient will be unable to notice things occurring in the left visual field. Okay, let's do a couple questions. A 64-year-old right-handed female is brought to the emergency department after the sudden onset of tingling and burning on the right side of her body. Upon examination, there is a complete loss of sensation of the right arm. What region of the brain is damaged? Okay, let's break down the question. With most neuro-related questions, you'll notice the question stem will often mention if the patient is left or right-handed. This is important because it tells you what is the dominant hemisphere in the patient. In this patient, we can see that she is right-handed, which means the left hemisphere is the dominant hemisphere. Also notice that the patient developed somatosensory abnormalities, which progressed to a complete loss of sensation of the right arm. We're asked what region of the brain is damaged. Because this patient is experiencing sensory deficits on the right side of the body, we can deduce that the left parietal lobe must be involved, specifically the left primary sensory cortex of the parietal lobe. So, left primary sensory cortex. Remember, all sensory and motor information crosses over to the opposite side of the body. So, if the right side of the body is affected, then we know that the left side of the brain must be involved. Okay, let's extend this question a little more. If the entire parietal lobe was involved, what other symptoms would you suspect in this patient? Okay, so we know that the left parietal lobe is damaged, and we also know that this patient is right-handed, so her left hemisphere is the dominant hemisphere. So left is dominant. Recall that when the angular gyrus of the dominant parietal cortex is damaged, the patient can develop Gerstmann syndrome. Because the question states that the entire parietal lobe was involved, and we know that this is the left or dominant hemisphere, we can deduce that the angular gyrus must be involved. In this case, we'd expect the patient to have the symptoms associated with Gerstmann syndrome. Remember, symptoms of Gerstmann syndrome include the inability to perform mathematical calculations, the inability to write, the inability to distinguish left from right, and the inability to identify fingers on the hand. Okay, let's see what your text says. So again, there are two important gyri that you need to be familiar with in the parietal lobes. This includes the primary sensory cortex and the angular gyrus. Again, the primary sensory cortex processes all the sensory input from the contralateral side of the body, and the angular gyrus is involved in performing mathematical calculations, writing, distinguishing left from right, and identifying fingers on the hand. It's also important to remember that damage to the angular gyrus of the dominant parietal cortex results in Gerstmann syndrome, and damage to the non-dominant parietal cortex results in hemispatial neglect. Okay, let's move on to the temporal lobe. The temporal lobe is right here. It's inferior to the lateral sulcus and anterior to the parieto-occipital sulcus. There are two important gyri that you need to be familiar with for step one. These include the superior temporal gyrus and the fusiform gyrus. The superior temporal gyrus is right here, and it's just below the lateral sulcus. This gyrus contains two important regions that you need to know for step one. This region here is the primary auditory cortex, which is responsible for processing auditory stimuli. Slightly posterior to it, right here, is Wernicke's area, which helps the patient comprehend what others are saying and also helps the patient speak in a logical manner. We'll talk about this more later. The fusiform gyrus cannot be seen very well from this angle, so we'll talk about this more in a second when we're looking at a coronal view of the brain. In addition to these two gyri, you also need to be familiar with the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the uncus of the temporal lobes. In order to see these, we'll need to look at the brain from a different angle. Again, this is figure 8.1, which shows an anterior view of the brain. If we cut the brain sagittally, slightly laterally to the midline, like this, and if we look at the brain from this angle, we can more easily see the hippocampus and the amygdala. This is figure 8.4 from your text, which is a lateral view of the limbic system and the basal ganglia. Again, this is a sagittal section of the brain, just lateral to the midline. Here we can see the thalamus and several important components of the basal ganglia, which we'll talk more about later. We can also see the hippocampus as it projects anteriorly, and at the tip of this region is the amygdala. It's important to know that the hippocampus is responsible for memory formation, and the amygdala is associated with emotions and decision making. Both of these structures are located in the temporal lobes of the brain and are an important part of the limbic system, which we'll cover in more detail later. Okay, now let's look at a coronal view of the brain and identify some of the important structures we've been talking about from a different angle. Recall that a coronal view is achieved by cutting the brain like this and looking at the brain from this angle. This is figure 8.5, which shows a coronal view of the brain. The lateral sulcus is right here, so the temporal lobe is the region inferior to the lateral sulcus, right here. The hippocampus is right here, and the amygdala is right here. The uncus can be seen right here, and it projects medially. Can see it a little better right there because it's not covered up. It's important to know that the uncus is associated with seizures, and it can also compress the third cranial nerve during an uncal herniation. An uncal herniation just means the brain is being compressed, which causes the uncal regions to press on the brainstem. The fusiform gyrus is right here, and it's just between the hippocampus and the inferior temporal gyrus. It's important to know that the fusiform gyrus is responsible for facial recognition. Okay, with this in mind, let's do a question. A 63-year-old male had a stroke 1 week ago, and he no longer recognizes his wife or children when they enter the room. What region of the brain was likely damaged? In this question, you need to know that the 63-year-old patient can no longer recognize faces. This is also called prosopagnosia, and this is caused by damage to the fusiform gyrus, as we just learned. Okay, let's see what your text says. There are six areas that you need to be familiar with in the temporal lobes for step one. These include the primary auditory cortex, Wernicke's area. Remember, both of these are in the superior temporal gyrus. The hippocampus, which is responsible for memory, the amygdala, which is associated with emotions and decision making, the fusiform gyrus, which is responsible for facial recognition, and the uncus, which is associated with seizures and can also compress the third cranial nerve during an uncal herniation. Okay, let's talk about the occipital lobe. Again, this is figure 8.3, which is a mid-sagittal view of the brain. This is anterior and this is posterior. Recall that the parieto-occipital sulcus separates the parietal and occipital lobes. For step one, it's most important to know that the occipital lobe houses the primary visual cortex. Damage to the occipital lobe would result in visual impairments, which we'll talk about in more detail when we cover ophthalmology. Okay, now that we've covered all of the major lobes and important landmarks, let's move on to discussing the homunculus. This is figure 8.6 from your text, which shows the homunculus. The homunculus is a representation of the body superimposed over the precentral and postcentral gyri. This figure may seem confusing at first, but it's actually pretty straightforward. So it's a coronal view of the precentral and postcentral gyri, and there's a human body overlaying on top of the gyri. If you can memorize this figure, then you'll know what part of the brain is responsible for producing the movement and sensation associated with each part of the body. For example, this image shows us that the medial aspect of the gyri are responsible for producing movement and sensation in the legs, because there's a leg right here. As we move more laterally, we can see that the arm, the face, the tongue, and the upper GI tract are all represented by these regions of the precentral and postcentral gyri. Okay, so now we're going to do another question. A tumor originating from the medial aspect of the right parieto-occipital sulcus projects anteriorly, compressing the postcentral gyrus. What symptoms would this patient likely experience? Okay, for this question, let's pull up figure 8.3 so we can clearly see what the question is referring to. This is figure 8.3, which shows a mid-sagittal view of the brain. And again, this is anterior and this is posterior. From the question, we know that the tumor originates right here near the parieto-occipital sulcus. And we also know that it's projecting anteriorly, like this. As we can see, the central sulcus is right here, which means the postcentral gyrus would be about right here. As we just learned, the medial aspect of the homunculus is responsible for producing movement and sensation in the legs. Because we know the tumor is only compressing the postcentral gyrus, we'd expect sensation to be abnormal and movement to be intact. So in this case, we'd expect the patient to have sensory abnormalities affecting the contralateral leg. From the question, we know the right postcentral gyrus is being compressed, so the patient would likely have sensory abnormalities affecting the left leg. So again, the right postcentral gyrus is affected, which would result in sensory abnormalities of the left leg. Okay, let's do another question. A 70-year-old woman presents with paralysis of the right leg. What region of the brain is likely damaged? So this question is pretty straightforward. From the question, we know that the right leg is paralyzed, which should make you think of the precentral gyrus. This is because the precentral gyrus is responsible for movement. Let's pull up figure 8.6 so we can see what part of the homunculus is affected. So again, this is figure 8.6, which shows the homunculus. Recall that the precentral gyrus is responsible for movement, and the postcentral gyrus is responsible for sensation. In this case, the medial aspect of the precentral gyrus is affected. Because the patient's right leg is paralyzed, we can deduce that the left lobe is damaged. So again, the medial aspect of the left precentral gyrus is damaged. Okay, before we wrap up section one, let's briefly discuss something called the internal capsule. Again, this is figure 8.5, which shows a coronal view of the brain. Recall that the precentral gyrus, or primary motor cortex, is the location of the upper motor neurons, which are responsible for movement. These neuronal cell bodies have axons that project down into the brain. So if we imagine that the precentral gyrus is right here, and these are all upper motor neurons, then their axons would move through the brain like this. This region here is called the internal capsule. And for step one, it's important to know that the internal capsule contains axons coming from the primary motor cortex. So all of these axons right here. So if we were to follow the pathway of a single upper motor neuron, it would start in the superficial part of the brain, as I've demonstrated by these red circles, and it would move down through the internal capsule. Okay, let's look at a transverse section of the brain. This is figure 8.7, which shows a transverse section of the brain. Recall that a transverse section is achieved by cutting from the anterior part of the brain to the posterior part of the brain, such that we're able to view the brain from above. So this is anterior, and this is posterior. As we can see, the internal capsule is this region right here. It's important to know that the internal capsule is broken down into three parts, which can more easily be seen on this transverse section. We have the anterior limb, the genu, and the posterior limb. The anterior limb contains fibers from the basal ganglia, cerebellum, and other structures, but this isn't particularly high yield for step one. For step one, it's most important to remember that the anterior two-thirds of the posterior limb, so about right here, contains motor fibers or axons of the corticospinal tract. Corticospinal. We'll talk about this tract in more detail in section two, but for now, just recognize that the anterior two-thirds of the posterior limb of the internal capsule is an important part of the pathway of the corticospinal tract. You also need to know that the posterior one-third of the posterior limb, so this region here, contains sensory fibers of the thalamocortical tract, which again we'll talk about later. Finally, the genu, so this region right here, contains motor fibers of the corticobulbar tract, which we'll talk more about in section 3.